Don Hankin sees the forests of California from a unique perspective, the long lens of history. He's a member of the Plains Miwok tribe and a scientist.
The history of the removal of fire from California's coastal landscapes began pretty early on with early Spanish settlement that limited the extent of where indigenous people could engage with fire.
I'm Sarah Goodwin, a scientist and storyteller at the Science Communication Lab, a nonprofit dedicated to science storytelling. I talked to Don for a film we were making about a catastrophic wildfire in California's oldest state park, Big Basin. Big Basin is home to some of the most majestic trees on Earth, the mighty redwoods. Redwoods evolved in an environment where fire has always been integral to the landscape, but climate change and over 100 years of fire suppression policies leave these trees especially vulnerable. Don has a job description that you may have never heard of, a pyrogeographer.
The way I define it is basically if you take fire ecology, which is looking at fire and ecosystems and the whole ecological connection of things, within geography, you can also add that human component. It's looking at the spatial, temporal relationships of fire in landscapes that also includes the human element. So when we think about a place like Big Basin as an example, you know, it's not only the natural fire regimes from lightning ignitions, as was the case with this fire starting, but also the role of indigenous peoples in stewarding with fire in that landscape. And so as a pyrogeographer, I look at those kind of relationships and how those systems evolved together to create the landscapes that we know of in these places. You know, when we look at indigenous peoples, such as Ohlone communities along the coast, in pre-settlement times, there were a lot of uses of fire in those particular places. So the redwoods themselves tell some of that history. They tell, when we look at like fire scars in trees and, you know, the cat faces that are there, those are in some cases from lightning. In some cases, those fires would be from indigenous burning. And more often, you know, along the coast, it's going to be the indigenous burning that's creating that kind of a feature within that forest. Not only in terms of the scarring on the trees, but also in terms of the structure of the forest and those sorts of things. So these are things that I look at as a pyrogeographer, those kind of understandings of the relationships. And for me, I'm mostly focused on like the prescribed fire aspect and the cultural fire aspect of using fire as a tool, not so much of looking at like wildfire impacts and that sort of thing.
I'm curious a little bit more about using fire as a tool and kind of what indigenous practices were, especially around the redwoods. And you mentioned they can shape what a forest even looks like. Could you tell me a little bit more about that?
If we think about some of the different ecosystems that are in Big Basin, and I don't have a long, you know, history or background of being in Big Basin, but having grown up on the peninsula, you know, I know what the redwood forest in, you know, elsewhere in the, on the peninsula contain. There's a mix of different things. So we think about the composition of different species. Some of those species are a little bit more fire sensitive, like Douglas fir, for instance, tends to be a little bit more fire sensitive. And so in areas where fire is less frequent, you might see more Douglas fir dominance in those areas. And then, you know, you go to other areas where Monterey pines are established, and Monterey pine is a species that tends to hold on to its seed until fire happens or you end up with a really warm day. And the cones open up and the seeds then spread from the canopy in that way. And so, you know, these landscapes all had fire as part of them. It's just a matter of how frequently was fire happening, at what intensities, and those sorts of things. And then there's places, you know, like if I'm thinking about places that burn quite frequently, you know, if Douglas fir dominated areas or areas where fire was less frequent, then maybe the grass dominated areas were the places where fire was happening more frequently, or places where there were other resource patches, specifically thinking about the cultural use of like berry plants like huckleberries that we observed while we were out in the field. Those kind of plants, they require to be stewarded with fire on a relatively frequent basis to maintain their productivity for that cultural use. And so there's a lot of different pieces of nuances of understanding the relationship between fire and the ecosystems and the and individual species outcomes and things like that.
Yeah, I'm curious a little bit about the history of the use of fire, like indigenous practices before the state park system or the U.S. government kind of decided on a different way of dealing with fire. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about that history.
Yeah, well, so from an indigenous cultural perspective, if we think about you know, the frequencies of fire and the stewardship of those landscapes, it's largely based on reading the landscape for the needs of what that landscape is. So if we don't put fire into a place for a relatively long period of time, we end up with an accumulation of litter on the forest floor or a decline in the health of the grassland systems. You know, if we look at each of these systems on their own, they each have a time frame for when fire should be applied through a cultural lens to maintain certain desired characteristics. And so as Ohlone peoples in this region would have been living in this landscape and using these different resources from the different ecosystems that are there, from the wetlands to the grasslands to the different oak forests and conifer forests and so forth, they each have their own time frames for when fire would be appropriate. So some places, like I said, would burn relatively frequently. People would see that, oh, the health of the grass is declining, we need to burn, or we're getting too much litter accumulation and on the forest floor and we're not seeing the forbs that we would find there, one for human use, two for wildlife habitat and food for animals and things like that. So burning is going to be the tool to do that.
So I'm in California. I'm in the Bay Area. And I know over the years, there's been a lot of conversation about decisions about fire suppression that have been over, you know, the last century that may be a cause of some of these major wildfires we're seeing. So if you could tell me a little bit about that history and how it's led to where we are today.
Well, the history of the removal of fire from California's at least coastal landscapes began pretty early on with early Spanish settlement. When we think about some of the first policies within the state that limited the extent of where indigenous people could engage with fire, that policy initially came out around 1793 from a proclamation from the Spanish governor of California that forbid indigenous people from using fire. And so, you know, that spread from Mission Santa Barbara outward. So that's why I say like the coastal areas really were first impacted by that. But then we also have disease and other things like that that were impacting indigenous populations at that same time frame. So the extent of burning was already shifting even without policy. But then with this policy in place, people were limited in being able to burn because there were really strict penalties applied to people who set fires. So you jump forward then to the 1910s and so forth with the Weeks Act at the federal level, establishing fire suppression policy. And this is all coming after a wave of really devastating wildfires in the western U.S. And then combining that with the desire to increase and maintain timber production, fire was seen at that time period as a thing that would not allow for that timber production to be where it needed to be for human use. And so these policies then were put into place to limit where and how fire could be and put all fires out under pretty strict terms. But I think in the long run, what we ultimately see is that, and we have to recognize this, is that fire is part of this landscape, that fire has always been part of this landscape and always will be part of the landscape. And so when you don't allow for fire to be in this place, what happens is obviously you end up with an accumulation of fuels, and under the right conditions, you know, right conditions in the sense of fire, you have a situation in place where you could have very devastating impacts from that fire. And I think the lightning example here in the CCU complex is a really good indicator of that, where you've got an absence of fire for well over a century in a lot of these areas, and then no prescribed burn even taking place and limited fuel reduction taking place. And so you end up with this massive amount of material that's accumulated on the forest floor, you know, everything from the fine leaf litter to larger branches and things like that. And then you add to that the effects of a prolonged drought along the coast and elsewhere within the state. And with a lightning ignition coming in and those conditions, it really sets it up for a perfect alignment for things to be the outcomes that we see from that fire.
Did the fire in Big Basin surprise you, or was it not surprising given all these conditions aligning?
You know, the fire in Big Basin didn't necessarily surprise me in the sense that this fire happened there. I think what was a little bit surprising to me was just the conditions in which it burned in, how extensive that fire was, you know, where it burned, how it burned, with the specific conditions under which it was burning, you know, thinking about the different wind patterns and the dryness at that time of year, Normally on the coast, we expect to see a lot of summer fog that would limit the dryness of the fuels and things like that. And this was just a season where we just didn't really have those kind of things in place. And so, yeah, that was a little bit surprising, but not so much surprising that fire would happen there. And like I said, I think when we look at Big Basin in the general area of the Santa Cruz Mountains, you know, there's obviously a history of fire that's there, but how frequently has fire been allowed to be in those places and where it had been for the last 100 years preceding this fire, not at the scale that it needed to be at, either temporally or spatially.
What was it like going to Big Basin that first time after the fire?
You know, for me being in Big Basin at that time, it was like being in the playground. It took me back to my childhood of going and looking at like the cat faces in the trees and thinking about the places that as a kid I would have wanted to be. And just to experience that in a freshly burned landscape, it was really, I guess, eye-opening in the sense that it allowed me to kind of see that for the first time. I'd never been in a redwood forest that had burned in that kind of severity before. And knowing that fire is part of that system, but then also to be able to not only look at the impacts of that fire in terms of devastation to certain vegetation within the forest, like Douglas firs and tan oaks that were top killed, but also to see the hope that these are resilient forests. You know, we look at the tan oaks, and even though many of them were top killed, a lot of them were basal sprouting. So these trees, the root systems were still intact and they were sprouting again. And the redwoods themselves, you know, have evolved with fire to the point that they were epicormic sprouting. So, you know, the sprouts that are coming off the trunk and the branches, we could see that growth happening despite it being, what, 6 months roughly from the time period when the fire burned through there to the time we were out in the field. You could see that resilience happening, and walking through a meadow that had been burned off and was completely vibrant green with sedges that were coming back in really talks to the evolution of these landscapes with fire. So I think that that was really something that was kind of a nice assurance and a reminder for me to see that, not only understanding that ecology, but also just that nature on its own is pretty resilient.
The conditions were kind of right for these catastrophic fires in 2020. Do you see attitudes shifting in terms of approaches to fire that might prevent these massive fires, or are these massive fires kind of our future? I'm wondering, like, living here, what are we to expect?
In terms of where we're going kind of in the future, I think as a state, and even probably at the national level, we're definitely recognizing on the policy side of it that fire suppression doesn't work so well. It works well if you're on it early and you can get it out, but it doesn't work in terms of the ecological health and so forth. And ultimately, you're going to have fire or some surrogate of fire within that system to maintain it. So what I've seen happening in particularly the last few years in California is a large effort to try to advance more support for prescribed burning and cultural burning. So several key pieces of legislation were passed within the last year to support that. We had the passage of SB 332 and AB 642, which support changes to liability standards for prescribed burning and cultural burning. We have the recognition of cultural burning within those pieces of legislation. We also have the state's Wildfire and Forest Resilience Action Plan that came out in January of 2021 that outlines the need to increase the amount of fire that we're using within the landscape. And the state in that document establishes goals of about 1 million acres per year by 2025. So trying to get to that level of burning, which is still a drop in the bucket when we think of the historic amount of fire that was happening within the state at the estimated 4.5 to 12 million acres per year that Stevens and others had come up with in pre-contact times in their paper from 2007, that understanding is really important to put into context of where, if we've only burned with wildfires in 2019 and 2020, roughly just under 4 million acres or around 4 million acres, that's still below what that 4.5 to 12 million acres average projection is. So in trying to get to 1 million acres, that's just a little piece of that, but I see that we're starting to build that synergy. I see the shift starting to happen with different agencies getting on board with it. And really, I think the bigger hope is really with private citizens and private landowners being able to do that. But in terms of agencies like state parks, they obviously have the ability to use fire, and they have been doing that in some places, but not so much here in Big Basin. So if we think about the places where they have been using it, like Calaveras Big Trees and Montana de Oro State Park along the Central California coast, those are good beginning places for it, but it really needs to be in all those natural land areas too.
Is there synergy or collaboration between the state systems or even private citizens and the indigenous practices and knowledge that has been accumulated over time?
There's definitely synergy that's there. The state's Wildfire and Forest Resilience Action Plan specifically highlights the need to collaborate more with tribal governments and tribal entities, and even some of the language within the state around what that means on the tribal side of it is starting to shift a little bit too, to recognize that it may not be the governments themselves, the tribal governments, but it may be individuals within the tribes or, you know, people who aren't from the recognized tribes who are carrying that knowledge. And it's about building the capacity to work with those folks. And so there's a lot of funding that's been coming forward for supporting that kind of stewardship. And in fact, I'm actually co-leading one of those efforts to advance indigenous fire across the state at this point in time.
So are you hopeful for the future of what fire could look like in California or even countrywide? Or is there trepidation? Or what are your kind of current feelings on what the landscape is looking like?
I definitely feel optimistic in terms of what the future holds for the restoration and application of fire within the landscape. I'm a little bit, I don't want to say hesitant, I'm a little bit concerned that the time that it will take for us to get to really making change is probably our biggest challenge. So when we look at the effects of climate change and continued loss of forest cover, in particular within the state and other communities that are receiving high severity fires and type conversion that's occurring, the question in the back of my mind is, how much longer do we have before we've type converted everything? For the redwoods, I'm a little bit concerned in the sense that if we think about the evolutionary history of where redwoods have been along the coast over the past 1,000 years or so, we know that climate change has happened. We know that there's been a northward migration of redwoods. And at what point do redwoods cease to exist in certain places along the coast where we know of them now? And that was one of the fears that I saw with this particular fire was, have we now lost the redwoods? When I first heard about it on the news, my thought was, have we now lost the stands of redwoods south of San Francisco Bay? I don't see that as being the case, but I think that if this sort of repeated fashion of fire were to happen, I think we could definitely be losing the redwoods along the coast. Big Sur area and the redwoods down there have had quite frequent fires in the last few years and quite devastating fires. That could also be the case for the Santa Cruz Mountains too. So I think we really just need to be moving along to get this advance as quickly as we can, but also as in an informed way as we can, so that we're not messing things up any further as we try to restore fire to these places.
It was a pleasure talking with Don, and I hope after listening to this discussion, you will check out our documentary that features him called Fire Among Giants. It is available on YouTube. We were some of the first people to be able to enter Big Basin after the fire, and our cameras captured this special place in ways never seen before. In addition to Don, you will meet other guides who will give you an up-close and thought-provoking tour through the redwoods. We also hope you will check out our other short films at the Science Communication Lab website, at www.sciencecommunicationlab.org. There you will also find other audio interviews of the people we featured in Fire Among Giants. Once again, I'm Sarah Goodwin, and I want to thank you for listening. Funding for this production was made possible by a grant from the National Science Foundation.